When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Spoilers are a path to the dark side. Spoilers lead to anger. Anger leads to hate. Hate leads to suffering. I sense many spoilers in this podcast from a galaxy far, far away in the series Star Wars Visions on Disney Plus, so beware of that. Also, What If? Hello. Welcome to episode 4 of X-Ray Vision, the crooked podcast where we dive deep into your favorite shows, movies, comics, and pop culture and more. Today we are covering the first 3 unbelievable episodes of the new anthology series Star Wars Visions on Disney Plus. Disgraceful. Plus news, recaps, and of course the endgame. But first, let's welcome back to the show one of our co-hosts, Cody Ziegler. Zig, how are you, sir?
I am thriving. It was a great topic to talk about. I'm currently on hiatus from my writing show, so I have been speeding through all the Star Wars movies in chronological order. Yeah. So this is a perfect episode for me. I'm glad to come back for marrying my love of anime and my love of lightsabers in Star Wars.
I can't wait to talk about all of that. Zig, of course, is a podcaster, writer of both comics and TV, including Rick and Morty, the up-and-coming She-Hulk. Let's get into it. In today's previews on, let's start with the shocking adaptation of a Marvel property, Hit Monkey, dropping November 17th on Hulu. 10 years ago when I read the Hit Monkey, if you told me that it one day would be a property that would be adapted, I'd be like, what? Mm-hmm. If you told me 2 days ago that it would be a property that somebody plucked out of the Marvel canon to adapt, I'd be like, what? Hitmonkey follows the adventures of a Japanese snow monkey, a macaque, voiced by Fred Tatasciore, assisted by the ghosts of an American assassin named Bryce, voiced by Jason Sudeikis, also starring George Takei as Shinji, Olivia Munn as Akiko. Sci-Fi Wire describes the series as this. Hit Monkey was originally one of 4 Marvel shows greenlit at Hulu alongside MODOK, Howard the Duck, Tigra, and Dazzler. Man.
What a slate.
Folks, drop the strain from that particular pitch meeting where all that stuff got greenlit because I want it.
Haters said it couldn't be done. Haters said they could not make a show about a Hitman monkey, but now it's here. I love to hear it. What a perfect time to be a comic book nerd. I can't believe, like you said, like when I read Deadpool versus Hitmonkey or whatever, like 15 years ago, I never would have pinged that one as the one that gets a show, and now I'm completely stoked for it. And the animation looks dope as fuck too. Like the trailer looked like, it was like, oh wow, this is like an action animated show. I can't wait for it.
Now everything but MODOK, obviously, and Hitmonkey got axed. But here we are, Hit Monkey. The trailer is out. I still can't believe we live in a world. The flex is unprecedented. Number one, it cool that they're using Hulu as like the place where you can see people get decapitated and stuff. Yeah. Like in a Marvel property, it's going to be like they're more adult, kind of more irreverent, non-canon world where you're going to see this stuff. Still, I can't believe that this happened. I have not checked in on Hitmonkey or Deadpool versus Hitmonkey in 12, 15 years, whatever it is.
Well, who has really? I mean,
who has?
Yeah. I mean, as you're saying, like, I do like the idea that Hulu is like the Marvel Knights or the Marvel Max line.
Right.
Of like, you know, we have like, you know, Disney Plus is pretty obvious. Like, they really sort of stick like the PG-13, but really PG for most of their stuff. So it is nice getting an outlet. We can see these like more eccentric characters go on more eccentric adventures and stuff, and also show a little bit of blood, show some dude get his arm ripped off, show a monkey air the clip out. Like, I'm all for it.
So for those of you who are like, what the fuck is Hitmonkey? What is it about? Going through the foggy archives of my brain from a decade plus ago, Hitmonkey is a Japanese snow macaque who comes into contact with a dying assassin who like was ambushed or something, and he wanders into like the mountains, comes across this tribe of monkeys who then take care of this assassin. But then Hit Monkey disagrees with this, but like learns assassining from this assassin. And mm-hmm. then much like John Wick or like the Frank Castle backstory, Hit Monkey gains these skills of assassining, but then the assassins that tried to kill the hitman come to the mountains. They kill his whole tribe of monkeys. Mm-hmm. And so now Hit Monkey, bent on revenge, goes and eventually kills them and has these adventures. He dresses in a nice suit.
Yeah, that's the most important part. He has like a little monkey tuxedo that he walks around the world in.
Like, where does this happen? Now, does that comport with your memories of Hit Monkey, the series?
Yeah, I mean, my introduction to Hit Monkey was through Deadpool. I think there was a run, or there was like maybe a mm-hmm. one-off series called Deadpool versus Hit Monkey, where Deadpool just gets his ass whipped by this little monkey for four issues. And I was like, okay, like, sign me up. Because, like, I mean, I'm a huge Deadpool stan. Like, he's one of my favorite characters. So, like, when he's getting fucking his ass waxed by a little monkey in a tuxedo, I was like, all right, this is a character I need to follow. Like, that tracks for me from what I remember reading it a decade and a half ago.
So wild. So I'm excited for this. I will say, let me just, I feel the need to say this, okay? It's been a tough time for Asian people just getting murdered by hitmen who are angry. Mm-hmm. That is it happening a lot. So hopefully this is done in a tasteful way. And I get it. Like, Hit Monkey is also is Asian. That mm-hmm. said, we can do more than just be bodies that get dropped. That said, I'm excited for Hit Monkey.
Yeah, I watched Kate recently on Netflix, and like, I'm like, man, this white lady just hurting everyone's feelings in Japan. This seems kind of crazy. Like, this is wild. Like, she's taking out Yakuza like this. I mean, okay, maybe she's a trained assassin, but yeah, I was like, oh, wow, this is wild. She's got numbers over here.
She was running up the score. Mary Elizabeth, I'm a fan.
Yeah,
but I had to turn the movie off. let's talk about What If, episode 6. What if Killmonger rescued Tony Stark? In which Eric Stevens, otherwise known as Killmonger, in the depths of his run of mongering kills, yeah. rescues Tony Stark from the Ten Rings attack in Afghanistan, goes on to become his buddy, basically blows up Obadiah Stane's spot mm-hmm. as Obadiah is in the midst of trying to betray Tony yeah. Stark, gets Tony's trust, gets a bunch of vibranium, and long story short, ends up taking over Wakanda. This was it feels like this is going to lead directly into the episodes that are coming, or mm-hmm. some other second part episode, because more than any of the other episodes, this one felt like there is a sequel somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah, this one in Marvel Zombies felt the most like, oh, this is setting up for either
yeah.
there's a two-parter later in this season, or like, I don't if they get another season, maybe they're going to do another thing where we'll just have like sequels stitched in that. But like, so I came into this having just seen Black Panther at the Hollywood Bowl, where they have like the live orchestra and stuff. So like, I was already like, dope. I was completely prepped for it.
I think this would have been, if there's a second part,
mm-hmm.
there's parts of this that were my favorite episode. First of all, Killmonger, I think I would argue at this point, maybe the best villain in the Marvel cinematic mm-hmm. universe canon, because yeah. what is the saying? Like, if the villain has a point, that's probably a good
yeah.
villain.
Yeah, look.
I don't know who has a better point than Eric Stevens.
Yeah, look. Not even my Hotep friends, like all my black friends, when Black Panther dropped, I was like, yo, Killmonger was talking that talk right now. I mean, he went about it in maybe not the best manner, but like, he's speaking some truth to power right now. Like, I'm kind of rooting for him. And like, even for this, like, you know, Thanos is such a big character, like, it's hard to like wrap your head around the idea of like mm-hmm. someone wants to extinguish half the fucking universe. Like,
yeah.
like when you get to trillions, like, you can't even comprehend that number. When it's like, yo,
yeah.
you gonna pay me what you owe? Like, I can relate to that. Like, I can 100% relate to Killmonger. I think that's why that villain sticks around so much.
I completely agree. You know, it's like, to your point of I might disagree with the methodology.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Killmonger is like, hey, y'all owe us. And the world is like, okay, well, let's figure out a payment plan. It's going to be a multi-step process. It'll probably take like half a century to maybe mm-hmm. a century to like actually work it all out. We'll spend the first 30 years to 50 years just like discussing whether or not we actually owe anything. And Killmonger's like, just no, forget all that.
Yeah,
like,
I'm trying to skip that Twitter discourse. Let's get right to it, B.
Let's get right to it. That part is what makes him so absolutely compelling. I will say, I love this entire episode. I have one note. My one small note is Michael B. Jordan needed to go harder in the paint on the Wakanda forever. I don't know if he, like, if they missed it, like, if they, like, clearly, like, Michael B. is a busy guy. They probably only had him for a very limited time. But when he recorded that line, it was like someone was sleeping in the next room and he was doing it on, like, Apple voice memo or something, because he was just like, whatever it was.
Yeah, it's like he was about to step into, like, his Uber Black to go to the airport. He's like, you know what? I got to knock this ADR request. Wakanda forever. All right, great. Send a check. We'll see you.
Wakanda forever. You know, like, when you put it in the back of your neck and pretend that you're screaming, like a fake falsetto or something, it's like, man.
He was walking out of the VO booth and yelling it into the mic as he was, like, leaving the session.
Wakanda forever. It's like, come on, man.
Yeah.
I needed that a little stronger. I'm excited. Of course, this is going to come out the day that the next episode of Marvel's What If is coming out, which has been teased to include Thor. What are you expecting for the end of the season of What If?
You know, it's such a mixed bag, and that being a good thing as far as, like, you know, these are mostly standalone episodes so far. I really do hope that they sort of start tying things into other stuff that's happened, because it's like, you know, in the Doctor Strange episode, like, that's the first time that we acknowledge that they're like, people can interact with the Watcher, at least people that are like that have cosmic seeings, cosmic, you know, intuition or whatever. So, like, I'm hoping that at some point that, you know, the Watcher gets brought in and, like, has something that affects the universe. Like, he needs to break his code. Like, that's always the thing with the Watcher. Like, you wait for him. You're waiting for him to break his code. And, like, I'm curious to see if that happens or what that thing is. Like, I'm wondering if they're going to tie in Kang to it all. Like, what's the Kang of it? Ooh. Since that's the person that sort of kickstarted all this whole multiverse conversation. So, like, I'm hoping that it becomes a little bit more canonical, and also that we see some, like, we have a more active Watcher like he was in the Doctor Strange episode.
Yeah, I agree. I think that I said this on last week's episode with Rosie, but I think that we're going to see the Watcher break his code, obviously. And I think that is going to take the form of him being like the cosmic Nick Fury assembling the guardians of the multiverse. Like, obviously, they don't know about each other. So the Watcher is going to be like, okay, the multiverse, you know, I'm out of a job if the multiverse goes. There's nothing to watch. Therefore, I'm going to have to put all y'all in contact with each other. Like, I know this hero. I know this corrupted Strange. I also know this Killmonger, who is bad, but maybe you could use him. I also know this T'Challa, who is Star-Lord. Like, and he's going to start plucking people from these various multi. I know this Captain Carter, and he's going to start putting them in contact with each other. And that will be the finale in which they take on, you know, Infinite Ultron.
Yeah.
That is my theory.
That's a solid theory. I'm with that one. I want to read it. I want to watch it.
Let's get into Star Wars Visions.
Like many of us, you might think identity theft will never happen to you. But consider this. There's a new identity theft victim every 3 seconds in the U.S. That's over 15 million people by the end of this year, equal to the populations of New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago combined. Even worse, identity theft victims often don't even know they're victims. That's why LifeLock Identity Theft Protection alerts you to identity threats, even the ones that don't show up on a credit report, like data breaches, fraudulent bank transactions, loan and credit card applications, and crimes committed in your name. If your identity is stolen, your own dedicated LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. LifeLock protects you in ways that you simply can't on your own. Join now and save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. That's LifeLock.com/iHeart to save up to 25%. Identity theft protection starts here.
Hi, I'm Cindy Crawford, and I'm the founder of Meaningful Beauty. Well, I don't know about you, but like I never liked being told, oh, wow, you look so good for your age. Like, why even bother saying that? Why don't you just say you look great at any age, every age? That's what Meaningful Beauty is all about. We create products that make you feel confident in your skin at the age you are now.
Meaningful Beauty. Beautiful skin at every age. Learn more at meaningfulbeauty.com.
By the Force since you were born.
At last, the moment arrives.
We're back. Today, we're stepping out of the airlock and into the Star Wars universe as never seen before in the new anime-inspired...
Yes.
You can say inspired? I mean, it's just anime.
Straight-up anime.
It's straight-up anime anthology series, Star Wars Visions. We're going to be covering the first three episodes, The Duel, Tatooine Rhapsody, and The Twins. These are, man, all very, very different and all very, very cool. Let's start with The Duel by Kamikaze Duga. In a remote village, a mysterious Ronin duels a Sith bandit leader while droves of armed bandits attempt to pillage and plunder a town. Ultimately, it becomes clear that our wandering Ronin is also maybe a failed Sith or just a Jedi who didn't go through with his training. Whatever the case may be, the duel is exciting and ends with the death of the bandit leader. The Ronin is voiced by Brian T, Sith bandit leader by Lucy Liu, and the village chief by Jaden Waldman, directed by Takanobu Mizuno. Just totally cool. There's going to be a standalone novel based on this. It's great that they started with this one because it is the one that makes the most obvious nod to the original Japanese cinema influences on Star Wars, the films of Kurosawa, this kind of like black and white, grainy texture. What did you think of this episode?
I'm going to be saying this a lot for every episode, but it is the exact shit that I wanted. Like you're saying, like, you know, it's, like, it's very much like, you know, it's Seven Samurai. It's the Hidden Fortress. Like, you know, it's a classic samurai chanbar or Western where like, oh, a drifter comes into town and they has to save them from the bandits. And like, I also love a running theme that's throughout these episodes is that the idea of like the gray Jedi or like the gray Sith. And like, I also love that they finally completely married. Like, the katanas are just lightsabers. Like they keep them in hilts for whatever reason. And like whenever my boy draws out his sword to like get into that first stance, like I'm with it. Like I also love that they have the callbacks to like other, like I love like the little Saboba guy is driving like the little droid racer. Like I love that the dude with the minigun is like that, you know, the assassination robot. Like I loved all that shit. I also love that, you know, just the art direction as far as like the bandits are like all like they have like the stormtroopers mask that are all like sort of held together with like, you know, duct tape and spit. Like it's a perfect introduction like to what this status quo that this series is trying to set as far as like we're gonna go in a galaxy that's far, far away, and because it's space, we can have like feudal Japan planet, we can have, you know, Miyazaki world, we can have like robot Astro Boy planet. Like it's the perfect worked episode to like get you primed for this world and what you're gonna be watching.
Yeah, this is exactly what I wanted, and it was the perfect way to open it. The vibe when the Sith bandit leader arrives, so the village guards, the chief of the village is a child, flips the script on the bandits who have rounded up the villagers. Out come the hired mercenaries that guard the town. And it's like, as you said, like one of them is like a bounty hunter droid with a huge minigun. Another is like a Bosk like Trandoshan with like two huge swords. Another one is like the Imperial spy drone from Empire Strikes Back with like samurai swords. And they just like wipe out these bandits. And then the Sith leader comes out of her ship, surveys the destruction, and just says very quietly, "Disgraceful." And then the music kicks in like, and I was like,
look, whenever the boss comes out and they say one word like mediocre, like someone's ass is about to get fucking whipped. And like she pulls out that she has like her like special lightsaber umbrella that like has like eight different spindles. I'm like, yo, yes, sign me the F up, boy. This is exactly the shit that I want.
Yes. It was just so cool.
You know, I had just, like I said, I had just rewatched all the Star Wars movies. So, like, seeing that sort of take on, like, the Anakin, Obi-Wan fight on, like, the lava, like, Mustafar, seeing them, like, on, like, the log going down the river, and, like, it was dope. It was such a fun, like, reimagining of what all the notes that we're used to seeing in these movies.
I agree. And I found myself thinking about the, like, globalization of, like, pop culture influences, mm-hmm. and how, you know, it must have been weird and disorienting, but also exciting to be like a Japanese person watching Star Wars and picking out all these influences and seeing how they were mashed together when you saw the first Star Wars trilogy. Similarly, to watch these speaking about The Duel right now by Kamikaze Yuga, and see the way all the Star Wars influences are just thrown together in a way that is very, it's very purposeful, but it's also, like, not bound by the quote unquote rules that would happen. Like, if this was an adaptation done by a Western studio or an American studio, they'd be like, well, you can't do this because where is this planet even? And this character was not around. And, like, how would they have gotten up? Forget that. Let's just throw all this shit together and it's cool.
Yeah.
I love that. There's, like, the energy of that is so fun, because I honestly, like, the childhood energy of Star Wars to me was just being like, oh my God, what is that? Who's that?
Yeah.
Who is that person that was in the background for 2 seconds?
Yeah.
What is that? Like, and this captures that, because it's like, it's just like all these little details that you want to know more about everything.
Yeah, well, it's like, you know, Boba Fett was like, oh, that's the dude with the cool helmet that says nothing in the second Empire Strikes Back. And, like, and even Bosk, like, you see his toes and you see his face. Like, that's all that he does in those movies. But you're like, oh, this dude looks cool. Like, I want to do this. And, like, I think that another cool thing, as you're mentioning, is, like, the idea of, like, since this is going to, like, Japanese studios, which are, like, obviously influence these movies, it's like they're being distilled down and reinterpreted by the people and culture that originally influenced it. So, like, they're able to have those tropes and cliches, like, and not even cliches in a bad way, but being like, they can like really hammer those home. Like, when Lucy Liu pulls out her lightsaber and the dude catches it with his hand for this force, I was like, that's my shit. Like, that's such that's such a classic clean trope in, like, any, like, you know, samurai anime or just samurai movies in general. And, like, seeing that applied through the force and, like, just seeing that, like, little tweak reinterpretation and, like, how they apply it to Star Wars was, like, such a breath of fresh air.
About the standalone novel, it's going to be written by Emma Miko Kanden. It arrives October 12th, expands the story of the Sith Ronin, according to StarWars.com. James Waugh, the VP of Franchise Content and Strategy, says, quote, out of all the shorts, The Duel felt most rife for an ongoing story in a novel. The team at Kamikaze Yuga were very generous in obliging our interest in continuing the storytelling, had a ton of ideas to lend in the creative process. The author, Emma, says, quote, I love that Visions as a whole is a grand recursive experiment, a fairy tale of a fairy tale, a myth built upon modern mythology. It makes the most sense in terms of, it's the most disconnected from other stuff. The other episodes take place, like, in particular worlds that you will recognize. So this is, it's the perfect one to kind of, like, stretch their legs on.
Yeah, it screams, like, side story, and that's what, I think that's a big offering that this particular episode, or even that, like, this micro universe can really expand on.
Next, Tatooine Rhapsody by Studio Colorido, Twin Engine. A former Jedi Padawan becomes the singer of an aspiring rock band, very subtly carries his microphone / lightsaber, like, on his belt, just, like, has it there. The band's name is Starwaver, and they ultimately come into conflict with Jabba the Hutt and Boba Fett because a member of their band is Jabba's son. And Jabba wants him back. The cast is Jay, played by Joseph Gordon-Levitt, Geezer, played by Bobby Moynihan, Boba Fett, Temuera Morrison, K-344 by Shelby Young, and Lan Mark Thompson. This was super fun. This is the one where you're like, if you start to think about where and when this possibly could have taken place, in Clone Wars, you're introduced to Jabba's son. Jabba's son is a child at that point. It's not clear that it's not the same person. This is, like, completely different. This takes place on Tatooine, like, in the pod racing arena. Super fun. Like, music based.
It's the most, like, anime of it all, as far as, like, we're gonna have a bunch of fun. It's gonna be a slice of life music anime, and, like, we're gonna just we're just gonna map Star Wars over it. Like, I love that Geezer is like his dirtbag son that has like he has like hair transplants and like a nose ring, and he plays he plays space bass in his garage band. Like,
I mean, this is perfect because like one of the music in Star Wars, bands in Star Wars is such a underexplored part of the in-world reality. Like, obviously, the there is the band on Jabba's barge. There is the band in the cantina. There is like music all around. But this is the first time we ever really explored it in a way that like centers it. And two, like, you know, in the world of Star Wars, other than the animation stuff, like just from the movies, you don't get, you don't very often, other than the music, get a sense of like culture, popular culture, what people talk about, like what people go and do as like entertainment other than like pod racing and like these little snippets of like a musical adventure. That's why I love this. The idea that there's like this band that's like on the rise out here in the galaxy is so fun.
Yeah, I mean, that's funny that you say that because we get those snippets of like people like going to bars, like going to cantinas. They like doing death sticks. But like that's really all that we have as far as like what people do when they're not like in war in this universe. So it is like it's such a fun like I this is one that I also want to see a sequel to. Like, I just want to see that world blown out because like it's such a fun niche thing that could only happen in this universe. Like you're saying, like, what are the dudes that play the space flutes doing the cantina band? Like, where are the influences? Like, where are they, like Miles Davis that like got them into like playing space jazz? Like, I want to see the Space Strokes. Like, what do these guys turn into, you know?
Yeah, the Space Strokes. I love that Jay's pitch to Jabba is like, hey, how about you become our first sponsor? What about that?
What a perfect, like, Star Wars is so heavy. Like, you know, good and bad must come together and face each other with blows. And this was like, yo, we need money for a new space fan. We would love if you didn't kill our bass player and we can make you a lot of money in the end.
I mean, look at this. Like, we filled the pod racing stadium. People are going fucking apeshit, Jabba. Like, do you want a part of this? Yeah. Also, don't pretend that I didn't see your tail tapping to the beat.
Yeah,
my guy.
Yeah,
you felt it.
Yeah, yeah. We use the slaps, Jabba, and we see you slapping with it. B, imagine we get Kendrick on a track. Game over. Space Kendrick.
I would say my one note is like maybe we should have brought in a pitch singer for Joseph Gordon-Levitt. My guy was like a full step and a half flat for the entire verse and chorus. Yeah. I got to feel that verse and chorus, and I didn't feel it quite as much as I needed to. But still, it was super fun.
He committed to it. He committed. And he also committed to like this little, my favorite like anime noise, like the all that stuff is like.
He went hard. Like, he went hard in the way Michael B. needed to go hard saying Wakanda Forever.
Yeah.
Because he like screamed the screams.
Yeah.
Really, really, really fun one. If people are feeling these first two animes, what would you say are like the comps to like go out and watch?
Yeah, I mean, the first one definitely, I mean, this is live action, but Yojimbo, like that's obviously Seven Samurai, but like anime-wise, I'd say Basilisk. It's a fun like samurai anime. It's like a Ninja Scroll. Like those are two ones I think are very fun cops that I think. Oh, and Sword of the Stranger. Like those are three that I think really compliment this. As far as like Tatooine Rhapsody, it's funny because I don't watch that much like musical anime, but like there's like a nice like slice of life. So like I think if you like just Google any like modern comedy anime, like that'll be a fun one to jump into. Any like anything that's like that looks bright and happy and weird and has like weird like character proportions, like you're going to be into it, and I think that'll be a perfect compliment for Tatooine Rhapsody.
Next up is The Twins, a really, really fun episode that really explores like the duality of the Force through twins bred and groomed to harness the power of the dark side. Guess what? One of them decides that they don't necessarily want to do that anymore, and then you get a fight.
Yeah.
The cast is Kare, voiced by Neil Patrick Harris, Allison Brie, and B20N, Jonathan Lipbaugh, directed by Hiroyuki Imeishi. Justin Leach, CEO of Cubic Pictures, said at the Anime Light Expo of the Twins, quote, subverts the idea of Luke and Leia and imagines a brand new set of twins born into the dark side and how far the brother will go to save his sister. Finally, we saw a humanoid General Grievous multi-armed Sith with lightsabers. That's all I want.
Yeah. I love my dark side waifu. I can save her. I can fix her.
She's problematic, but just give me time with her.
Yeah, she's my problematic fave. We'll get some couples therapy. We'll fix her. Speaking of, like, coming off the you know, Joseph Gordon-Levitt going for it, Alison Brie fucking went for it in this as well.
Went for it hard.
Like, she went hard in the motherfucking paint. I think, I mean, this is of the ones that we were reviewing today. Like, this is the one that is the most, like, bombastic anime, like, that could only, that could, things that could only transpire in animation that lends itself to this. Like, just to jump straight to it, like, my dude making a hyper lightsaber out of a special crystal and then jumping on front of an X-Wing and going through hyper speed to, like, cut a Star Destroyer in half is the most hype shit I've ever seen. And also shit that could only get away with by Studio Trigger, the production company that made this one. Like, that's their bag. Like, they do bombastic, hype-ass, hyperkinetic animation, and they completely get away with it. Now, if I'm asking myself, why does the droid have a spacesuit on at the end? I didn't even care. I was like, you know, I chalk it up to the Force.
I mean, why does, like, Kare have an X-Wing, like, on an Imperial ship? Yeah. None of it. It doesn't matter.
Doesn't care. It doesn't matter.
Don't worry about it. It's interesting because when I was, I spent all weekend just, like, reading histories of anime. And there's some really good economic papers about, you know, just, like, the movement of pop culture in the 21st century and how anime is an example of a market that was, the spread here in the United States is an example of a market that was purely fan driven. Like, everybody who tried to make this happen from an actual, like, professional corporate level failed in numerous ways. Either the Japanese studios couldn't find a partner that would honor their material, that wouldn't just, like, cut it up and dub, like, wild shit over it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or they couldn't find a distributor who understand what they were about. Similarly, meanwhile, the fans were just like, send these tapes over. We will translate them on our own and we will disperse them on our own. Mm-hmm. And we will do that because nobody is feeding this market. Literally nobody else is doing this. And it is super fascinating. And one of the things that was driving this was that, to your point, there was a level of bombast that was just not seen in American/Western animation, which is primarily for kids.
Yeah.
Like, in Japan, the tradition is, the manga tradition is, this is popular storytelling for everyone. Like, you see adults reading this. Similarly with anime, there's no, like, age cutoff for this shit. Like, adult themes, incredible violence. Like, if you want to know, you know, what's a shortcut to, like, universal storytelling, stylized violence, incredibly stylized violence in which, like ships containing a million people get blown up or cut in half.
Yeah.
You know, that is the shit you will see in anime. And that was the thing that really hooked people in the late 70s and 80s because they were like, oh my God, what the hell is this? I've never seen anything like this.
Yeah. And
that was what the Twins felt like to me.
Yeah, 100%. Because I'm thinking of that. Like, you know, we had, like, G.I. Joes and Transformers, which were like, nothing really happens. Like, you know, there's no stakes to, like, what you're watching. Like, there's, like, Roadblock. I'm assuming there's a character named Roadblock. That sounds like a wrecker. Like, Roadblock's not getting his leg blown off in episode one and then have it not be there in episode two. Like, there are just no stakes. But for this, is like, one, is like, you also, like, everything is dialed up to fucking 25. So, like, the emotions are super heightened. Like, it's just, like, also, it compacts everything down. Like, you get the Leia and Luke story in, like, what is this, like, 15 minutes? Like, you get all that compacted really to one sequence in, like, a 15-minute thing. So, like, already, like, you're fucking speeding through this at 100 miles per hour. It's like, you're on edge, and, like, you want to see how it plays out because also the animation is so kinetic and dialed up to 25.
Yeah, to your point, as a fan of G.I. Joe as a kid, it used to annoy me so much that every time G.I. Joe and Cobra would get in, like, some scuffle to you know, the big set piece battle at the end of every episode, they'd be blowing up each other's jets, big explosion. As the jet gets shot down, you know, the pilot would eject and you see the parachute and they, like, gently drift to the ground to let all those kids watching at home. Don't worry. Nobody. This is a huge battle between two multinational security forces and like a wild high-tech terrorist outfit, but actually nobody died in any of these battles. Don't worry about it.
Yeah.
So, you know, had anime come into my life at that time, I would have been like, yes.
Yeah, you would have been scarred there. I remember the first time the first anime I ever watched was this show called Robotech. And like that was a show that was serialized, and like one of the main characters bites it like episode 8. I'm like, wait a minute, is he going to be here like next episode? Like, no, he bleeds to death in his hospital bed. It's like he's gone. I was like, oh wow, I'm not used to this. I'm used to like Optimus Prime coming back the next Saturday or whatever.
I mean, like, you know, for me, one of the most scarring moments in childhood animation is Optimus Prime dying. I was like, wait, what? How can you do this? How dare you?
Yeah.
You know, meanwhile, in anime, people are dying, getting cut in half, like, all the time, and it mattered.
Yeah. They don't get graceful deaths. They're like, they get fucking murked by someone that they loved. You know, they get killed in a phone booth, and you're like, oh, wow, no dignity in this death.
So when you watched Robotech, were you watching the original Japanese Robotech, or were you the dubbed version? Or
I was watching the Harmony Gold dub. So like, I'm a Toonami stan. Like that fucking changed the game for me. I was like 12 or 13, and like that was the first like anime I ever saw. I was like, oh wow, this is one. Like, it had robots. I love robots, but also it was the first show that I'd be cognizant of being like, oh, this is serialized. Like, what happens in episode 1 is going to affect episode 27, which is going to affect episode 32 or whatever. And like, having those stakes happen, also having like characters that you attach to and then having them die, was like, oh wow, this is like, this is real. Like, I've never seen that type of stuff. And like, that's what fucking unlocked the gate to like the nerddom that I currently find myself yelling about anime Star Wars right now. One big snowball, baby.
So of these three, which is your favorite and why?
Oh man, it's
the Duel, Tatooine Rhapsody, and the Twins.
I think aesthetically distilled down, the Duel is what for me is like what I think Star Wars is when it comes to like the influences, the action, the subtle stuff as far as like, you know, good, bad, and even having the idea of like the gray, like this also the Twins covers the idea of like someone turning to the light. Like, I love all that. Also, it's in and out. Like, you get a taste of like these worlds can be whatever they want to. Like you said, we can have feudal planet, we can have you know, we can have rock garage rock planet. Like, the Duel hits all that stuff, and also you see all the love letters to like Yojimbo, Seven Samurai, all those things are still down that I think the Duel just like really captures. Like, it's what you it's the perfect pilot for what you need right out the gate for this series.
Yeah, that was my favorite one as well. I think then followed by the Twins. Mm-hmm. The Duel, there is something perfect and circular about like closing that loop and acknowledging original influence of Kurosawa's pictures on Star Wars, you know, famously Hidden Fortress.
Mm-hmm.
Lucas openly took a bunch of plot points from that movie and used it to build up the early drafts of Star Wars. Like, at one point, the character that became Darth Vader was named General Akira.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of stuff in there. And so acknowledging that was super cool. And then just the textures and feel of it, like taking animation, putting that like dirty film, black and white, gray film grain, but then having the lightsabers have these pops of color, the laser beams be these pops, with blasters be these pops of color, the explosions
that little
be these
blue
pops of color.
On his like on his wrist, like his
to call his R2 droid, the way that it took like the archetypical essential story beats of a Star Wars story, right? The battle between good and evil, these lived in high-tech futuristic worlds where you can imagine people just like working and going about their day, an incredible Duel, droids, like all that shit together in basically like under 13 minutes, I think.
Yeah.
It was just it was the perfect introduction. And I think, you know, for me, who is not as versed in anime, there is so much Star Wars there, and it's so upfront with its influences that you feel like it's like a great syllabus to be like, I want to dive in further. How do I get there?
Yeah, it's a great like cultural bridge. We're like, all right, we're going to bring fans over to anime. We're going to bring anime fans over to Star Wars, and like we can all have them populate and find some more gems in both of those mediums of storytelling.
If people wanted to get into some of these, the studios that created these, Kamikaze Douga, Studio Trigger, Twin Engine, do you have like a some movies that they should check out or some?
Studio Trigger. Studio Trigger is one of the best in the game. Like what you saw for the twins is a great encapsulation of like their style when it comes to like character design and like action and like also humor. I highly recommend Kill la Kill. That was probably like one of their most well-known first series. I think it's on Netflix. All the seasons are on there, or Hulu, one of the two. And also if you're looking for like a feature that they did, Pro Mare, I think Promare, that's on, I believe, Amazon. It's a fantastic, fantastic feature with like some amazing animation, and some crazy character designs. That's also like that, their style, if you notice, like they don't do a lot of like borders for their stuff. Like they'll have like outlines for characters, but a lot of their like background is just like the paint. That's it. You don't get any like bordering and stuff. Like that's a really cool, film to see like that throughout like a whole feature. I highly recommend both of those.
This has been so fun. I can't wait to have you back so we can talk about the rest of the season. Up next, I crack open the omnibus. Welcome to another chapter in the Omnibus, where lore, analysis, and understanding come together. Today, we explore the life and work of director Akira Kurosawa, his influence on Star Wars, and the globalization of anime, which set the stage for Star Wars Visions, the series that we are watching and talking about today. It makes sense in all of this to start with The Hidden Fortress, director Akira Kurosawa's 1958 classic about a mismatched pair of commoners who bumble their way into a mission to rescue a willful princess from the upheaval of a civil war is the most famous example of the influence of Japanese culture on Star Wars. Whenever the film comes up in conversation, someone will mention, hey, George Lucas was inspired by that to make Star Wars. Indeed, George Lucas's early scripts for A New Hope hewed so closely to fortresses that, according to John Baxter and George Lucas' biography, the director briefly considered purchasing the film's remake rights. Quote, Hidden Fortress was an influence on Star Wars right from the very beginning, Lucas says in J.W. Rinzler's The Making of Star Wars. Fortress is known as a jidaigeki, a genre of action adventure usually set during Japan's Edo period, which is thought to be the phonic source of the word Jedi. In the first draft of Star Wars, the villain who became Darth Vader is named Akira. Obi-Wan Kenobi would have hit different if the actor playing him was the Hidden Fortress's star and frequent Kurosawa collaborator Toshirô Mifune. And Lucas explored the possibility of casting Mifune before settling on Alec Guinness. And of course, the Jedi themselves are essentially space samurai. Akira Kurosawa casts a Death Star-sized shadow over American popular culture and international cinema. 1950's Rashomon won the Golden Lion at the Venice Film Festival and launched Kurosawa to global acclaim. The movie occupies an interesting cultural space. On the one hand, it's only been officially remade once, 1964 is The Outrage, starring Paul Newman. On the other hand, since its release, every story which has come out, every movie in which a single event is examined from multiple points of view owes something to Rashomon. Rashomon has since become a synonym for the subjective nature of reality and the punchline for a very, very funny joke on The Simpsons. Basically, Marge is like, you liked Rashomon. And then Homer is like, no, I didn't. And then they remember this one situation very differently. Kurosawa's 1961 film Yojimbo and its sequel Sanjuro introduced the trope of the mysterious protagonist, later popularized by Clint Eastwood's character in Sergio Leone's A Fistful of Dollars trilogy. The man with no name would later influence Logan's look and vibe in Frank Miller's four-issue Wolverine limited series. Another major influence on Star Wars, Kurosawa's 1954 masterpiece, The Seven Samurai, is credited with creating the team of specialists on a mission trope, which spawned any number of movies and stories that you can imagine. The Fast and the Furious, Marvel's The Avengers, The Ocean's 11, the remake, and almost every heist movie of the last 60 years. The Town. Akira Kurosawa was born in Tokyo in 1910 to a family descended from samurai. The youngest of eight children, Akira wanted to be a painter. His father, however, a former military officer and physical education teacher, encouraged him towards the cinema, which was just then emerging in Japan. In 1935, Kurosawa answered an advertisement from PCL Studios and was hired on as an assistant director the next year. During this time, Japan was reaching the culmination of a decades-long program of rapid modernization. In the late 1860s, Japan was a fractious collection of feuding states with a weak military, a pre-modern agrarian economy hamstrung by extortionate trade treaties forced on the country by Europe and the United States. Fast forward to 1912, and Japan has a strong central bureaucracy governing the country, which enjoyed a burgeoning industrial base, a highly educated population who zipped around the country in a modern railway system. Once preyed upon by colonial powers, Japan, behind its modern army and navy, had itself become a colonizer after prying the Korean Peninsula away from China in 1895. The lasting effects of that continue to this day. When Russia, one of the so-called great powers of the era, began encroaching on Japan's Korean holdings, Japan in 1904 launched a surprise attack on the Tsar's fleet, sparking the Russo-Japanese War. Japan's defeat of Russia, it's fair to say, shocked the world and elevated Japan to a first world power. And it is really hard to fathom from an American perspective what the effect of this rapid tectonic change had on Japan and its culture. In The Asian Influence on Hollywood Action Films, Barna William Donovan writes of this period, quote, "Japanese society, founded on centuries of reverence for tradition and a very powerful sense of cultural identity, would now begin to struggle with the question of how modernization, industrial development, foreign contact, and the need to attain the status of a global power could, at the same time, remain compatible with their insular traditional Japaneseness." Kurosawa's career as a director took place during and immediately after World War II. Under Japan's wartime censorship regime, films were, as Leonard Epp describes in the Oxonian Review, quote, "anti-Western and preferred representations of devoted and unindividuated workers who were subordinate at least to a social goal, if not also to a received and semi-feudalistic notion of an authentic Japan, which was under attack from Western influences," end quote. During the American occupation, the Americans put in their own censorship regime, and in addition to managing what American and European movies could be shown in Japan during this time, Alfred Hitchcock's Lifeboat, for instance, was denied because it depicted a Nazi captain briefly in control of the fate of the lifeboat's passengers. 1945's A Medal for Benny was not allowed to be shown due to the film's celebration of the protagonist's killing of numerous Japanese soldiers during wartime, probably a good idea. The bureaucracy demanded that domestically produced films break with Japan's feudal past and should criticize Japan's wartime actions. Akira Kurosawa's 1945 film, They Who Tread on the Tiger's Trail, was denied release because it was set in 12th century feudal Japan and promoted Japanese feudal values. It was released later in 1952 after the Treaty of San Francisco, which reinstated peaceful relations between Japan and the United States and ended the American occupation. But by then, of course, Rashomon had won Kurosawa international recognition and set his career on a path toward the most rarefied levels of influence, respect, and acclaim that an artist can reach. It is ironic, then, that Kurosawa's reputation in his home country at the time and now is decidedly mixed. In the early 1970s, new wave Japanese directors reacted against Kurosawa's reputation and his perceived cinematic authority, writes Leonard Epp in the Oxonian Review. They rebelled against what they saw as an American style, which was overly individualistic and too directly influenced by Westerns in the style of John Ford, end quote. Kurosawa was always open about his admiration for American films and Western literature, and most notably, the work of director John Ford. This, along with, ironically, his acclaim in the U.S., was used against Kurosawa by his critics and contemporaries, who derided his work as old-fashioned, elitist, arrogant, and shaped by the biases of a Western audience, pandering to American audiences, essentially. By the 1960s, Kurosawa found himself out of step in Japan, but with the standing of an auteur in Hollywood. In 1966, 20th Century Fox hired him to direct the World War II epic Tora 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 about the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. After working on the script for 2 years, Kurosawa was either fired or resigned 2 weeks into shooting. The rumor has it that he was too authoritarian with his American actors. If that's the case, there was surely some kind of like cultural misunderstanding there as well. That said, I think it's fair to say, if you read anything about Kurosawa, that he was quite imperious with the people he worked with. Let's put it that way. I think it's fair to call him arrogant. In 1970, Dodeskaden, Kurosawa's first color film, was savaged by Japanese critics, and it later flopped at the box office. Kurosawa fell into a deep depression and in 1971 attempted suicide. In the last decades of his career, the filmmaker would find it impossible to finance his projects in Japan. George Lucas, Coppola, and Spielberg used their clout with American studios to raise funds for Kagemusha in 1980, Ran in 1985, and Dreams in 1990, writes Barna William Donovan. Kurosawa's dip in fortunes was, ironically, in part a failure to react to the rise of television in Japan. Japanese film studios never recovered from the shock of television. While younger directors adapted to the new age by making cheaper films or working for television, Kurosawa refused. Ian Baruma wrote in a 1989 article about Kurosawa. Japanese television's ascent was fueled, ironically, in part by the domestic audience's hunger for a new form of entertainment, anime. The transnational pathways of globalization that led us to Star Wars Visions just wander off in really, really unexpected directions when you dig into it. In the 1970s, new consumer products invented and mass-produced in Japan, notably the Walkman, but in particular, for our purposes, the Betamax and most influentially, the VCR, the video cassette recorder, made culture portable in a way that was simply impossible previously. Americans in Japan, many of whom were members of the military based in the country, began recording Japanese broadcasts of shows like Astro Boy and Star Blazers off Japanese television and sent the tapes back to the States. In May 1977, several Los Angeles area anime enthusiasts founded the Cartoon Fantasy Organization, CFO, the first anime fan club, and the organization quickly spread. The Cartoon Fantasy Organization will meet from 10:30 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. today behind the bank of the hills on Research. Features will include Grandizer, Dangard, Dangard Ace, Space Ketters, Star Avengers, Brave Radiant, and Astro Boy. The group meets on the second Saturday of each month, end quote, reads an event posting in the September 12, 1981 issue of the Austin American Statesman. The October 12, 1984 edition of the Philadelphia Inquirer ran a bemused coverage of the Philadelphia chapter of the CFO's second anniversary meetup. Quote, a little unusual, this CFO is, but definitely original. While other Philadelphians are cruising Saturday night hotspots trying to look like Michael Jackson or Prince, the club's members are searching for artistic and creative merit in science fiction shows that the rest of the world might find terribly strange. That's 1984, folks. A rather good profile of the CFO appears in the November 19th, 1987 edition of the Chicago Tribune, which states that the CFO at the time had 30 chapters with several thousand members in Chicago, Denver, Dallas, Houston, San Francisco, and other cities. In a 2004 paper, Progress Against the Law, about the spread of anime in the U.S., cultural globalization, and copyright theft, which I urge you to read if you want a great history of anime up to the mid-2000s, MIT's Sean Leonard writes that anime fan distribution networks, quote, represented proselytization commons, or spaces where media and ideas could be freely exchanged in order to advance a directed cause, which I think is a good description of the internet in 2021. An examination of Japanese and American popular culture cross-pollinization reveals these dizzying metatextual details that surround us. It's not often clear who pollinated whom. Up next, Alicia Lutz joins us for The Hive Mind.
Hi, I'm Cindy Crawford, and I'm the founder of Meaningful Beauty. Well, I don't know about you, but, like, I never liked being told, oh, wow, you look so good for your age. Like, why even bother saying that? Why don't you just say you look great at any age, every age? That's what Meaningful Beauty is all about. We create products that make you feel confident in your skin at the age you are now.
Meaningful Beauty. Beautiful skin at every age. Learn more at meaningfulbeauty.com.
I'm late. for a very important date.
Time is running out to score adult theme park tickets at child prices from Undercover Tourist. This summer, make your Walt Disney World vacation more affordable than ever. Escape into a place where magic has the power to transport you into stunning worlds and your favorite stories for less. Buy from Undercover Tourist, an authorized seller, and link to official Walt Disney World apps so you can add on Genie Plus and Lightning Lane upgrades easy. Book your adult theme park tickets at child prices with Undercover Tourist now and save. UndercoverTourist.com.
Welcome to The Hive Mind, where we dive deeper into a particular topic with the help of a guest panelist on today's episode. X-ray Vision is happy to welcome writer Alicia Lutz. You can find her most recent article on Vulture, which features an interview with Ted Lasso's Phil Dunster. Alicia, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Jason. It's a thrill.
Let's talk about, with the release of Star Wars Visions, it's worth unpacking the role that the movies now play in the overall firmament of the Star Wars universe. I guess we could boil that topic down to, does it matter if the Star Wars movies suck or not? The most recent trilogy, I think the general consensus is it was disappointing. But it feels like with Star Wars Visions, with The Mandalorian, with all the various Disney Plus shows that are coming out, with Star Wars Rebels, with the finale of Clone Wars, it kind of doesn't matter because we have so much stuff. Let's talk about it. Alicia, let's start with you. Does it, like, where do you think, what is the role of the Star Wars movies now with all this other Star Wars content that is out there?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I think that Lucasfilm and Star Wars thought really big, but they got themselves stuck in a trap by sort of repeating old patterns and thinking that they're getting...
It's a trap! Sorry, I had to do it. I know, I thought about not doing it, but then I felt everybody listening to this doing it, so then I had to do it. I'm sorry, continue.
You know what? It's fair. It's absolutely fair. I think that it's just... They set themselves up for failure with the most recent trilogy, although I am somebody who does like a lot of what was being presented in The Last Jedi, even though that there's very constructive and valid reasons why some of the things in that film didn't work. But what I think Rian Johnson was trying to get at in that was that the Force belongs to everyone. And I think that we're getting to see that in Star Wars Visions. We're getting to see that in, you know, Clone Wars and Rebels, and you get to see these other parts of the universe that have so many different stories to tell. And it's just such a deliciously verdant breeding ground for all of the different types of stories that can be told in this vast universe. Like, it's galaxies. It's not just one family just doing the thing over and over again, you know?
Yeah, I think it was Karl Marx who said that we must seize the means of producing the kyber crystals and socialize the force for everyone. Yeah, I feel the same way about the most recent trilogy, and that there's like a lot of stuff to admire. Honestly, in all the three movies, The Last Jedi is my favorite of those. There was good stuff in all of them, but on the whole, it felt a little bit like movie making by committee,
yes.
Whereas The Mandalorian, Rebels, and now Star Wars Visions, there is a reason behind them existing, and there's something that they are saying.
Totally.
Zig, what are your thoughts about like where the movies stand in the current content offerings?
I mean, both of y'all are spitting straight facts right now. I think that one is I was just telling Jason I had just rewatched all the movies in chronological order because I'm very unemployed at the moment. So my big takeaway rewatching the newest trilogies is that like there's not a lot of fun in them. Like the first, like Star Wars Awakens is like the most fun. We're like, oh, we got wacky jokes and stuff. But like even watch the original trilogy, like it's like watching it. I mean, it's obviously made for kids. And like, that's something that like sort of permeates throughout all of them. But like the newest trilogy where like, you know, you're wrestling with like the light and dark stuff, which is interesting, but like, it's also like so heavy. And like the second, like the whole third act of like the first one is just like so not fun. Like,
yes.
And also like, there's this whole like mystery box stuff, which like, you know, I'm not a big fan of that in general. Like there's no real mystery in the original. It's like, you don't wonder who Luke's parents are. Like, you don't care. You're just like, oh, this is a kid. Mm-hmm. He goes on an adventure. He meets some weird people, and like, that's his thing. Like, I don't care about how the person got there. And like, speaking to your point about like, you have this enormous galaxy, which I think the TV shows really tap into. Like, you get to see what happens with like the squad of like the bad troopers, or you can see what the Mandalorian does, or you can see like what Ahsoka is doing up to. But like this, it seems the movies seem so contained because it's just two bloodlines. And like, the whole thesis for The Last Jedi, which I really enjoyed, was that like, who gives a shit? Throw out the good, the bad.
Totally.
It's not about this. Like, it's about starting something over with. And like, I really enjoyed that. And I felt there was a little bit of an undercut at the end when like the kid that we see that gets powers is like another white kid. You're like, I've seen that in like 9 movies. Like,
yeah,
it's like there's like a black kid like right there. Give it to them. Like, there's like a little brown girl. Like, give that to them. And like, the course correction in like the last of three was just like, yeah, maybe the films could be sort of a thing where they make these big they set up like more stuff for the world. So like, it's a big well that they can go back to. Like, all right, we need to establish that there's like the final order or whatever. Like, all right, we'll set this up in one movie, and then like, we can just have that permeate through like the TV shows if they want to go into that and like tap into these certain things. Like, I think maybe doing standalone is maybe the move. Like, Rogue One was great. Solo was fantastic, in my opinion. I think having small self-contained stories might be the move going forward, because also like, trilogies are just sort of a going out of the way. Like, you know, besides Marvel, like, I don't know if trilogies is like the move for like features at this point, storytelling
wise. Yeah, I agree. Rogue One is my favorite, and I think part of that is because it is a different angle on the story that, you know, it's filling in one, it's answering a story, which was like, how did they get these plans, you know, ever since you know, you heard about the spy mission to acquire the plans, you're like, oh, how did this happen? So now you get that, which was so cool. And also, it just wasn't based, it is no more Skywalkers, like, it wasn't, these were like all new people, and you really felt it when they died.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting because the fact that that Clone Wars exists, that Rebels exist, kind of, for me at least, softened the blow of the disappointment of, you know, the new trilogy. The fact that it wasn't that great didn't leave me crushed in the same way that the prequels, when the prequels came out, and it was like, what the fuck was that? It really like hurt me.
Yes. Yeah.
Because I was like, now it's like, it's unclear that novelization stuff is even canon anymore. And now this kind of sucked. Like, what are we going to do? And it wasn't until Clone Wars kind of got going years later that all of that stuff got recontextualized and became kind of cool. But this makes it so that not everything hangs on the movies just being good. I do wonder, you mentioned Marvel. Like, I wonder if they go for a kind of like Marvel architecture, in that they have these kind of like one shots. We're exploring the universe.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go over here and check out what these rebels are doing over here. Let's see what this spy faction is doing over here. Let's just go off and check out a weird world. And then, much like the Marvel movies, there's some kind of thing that teams them all up in a later movie. And that breaks you out of like this kind of like trilogy architecture, which, yes, Star Wars kind of like pioneered, but feels like old movie thinking.
It's so stale now to do sort of like this. It's very expected to do a trilogy or a quadrilogy, or, you know, to do these big sort of sequelized stories. But I think that because of the financial pressure on a business standpoint of what it takes to make those movies happen, it makes so much more sense to have your sort of area of exploration and play be on television, be in these little stories. And I mean, we got to see, especially in Visions, just the what happens when you let people do what they're good at and really like let them just play and have fun and tackle some of the themes that Star Wars does so well, but in a completely different, from a completely different perspective. I think it's just it's what this universe needs.
Yeah, and even the speaking of that, like, the cultural half-life is so much longer when like you're releasing an episode every week. Like, for 2 months to 2.5 months, everyone talked about was Baby Yoda. That's all that they talked about. I was up there with the bullhorn yelling about how much I would die for this little puppet.
Big save.
It was like with the movie that comes out, you know, you have really 2 to 4 weeks of like, all right, you know, did you see the new Star Wars or whatever? And then it's like just dead. But with having this like recurring thing coming out, also you're stacking that. So like you'll have Mandalorian, you'll have the Bad Batch, you'll have whatever coming out. Like it just stays in the cultural zeitgeist so much longer than just a film which comes out and then it's gone in less than a month, unless it's like, you know, Endgame or whatever.
That's a great point. I was working at The Ringer at the time that the first Mandalorian season came out, and people who don't care about Star Wars, don't give a shit about sci-fi or fantasy that work there would be like, when the subject of Baby Yoda came up, like there was a moment, it was like, you could feel the energy change in the room. Like my former editor, Chris Ryan, like his wife was like, if you get a chance to see Baby Yoda, to meet Baby Yoda, to go and see the prop, like you have to take me. Not a person who like cares about sci-fi. And that was like the vibe. There were people who were just like, listen, if Baby Yoda is coming by the office or if anybody gets to go see Baby Yoda, please tell me, because I want to go see Baby Yoda. Like that, I have not experienced something like that in a while, where it was just like this little prop doll baby, animatronic Grogu baby, 50-year-old child, just like was something that so many people needed.
Yeah.
And that's not a thing that could have really happened in a movie.
Yeah,
totally. Mm-hmm. And like, I also think the pandemic of it all probably played into that a little bit. We were all looking for some joy, but like,
yeah,
again, it was taking something that we are very familiar with, you know, Yoda, and just flipping it on its head just a little bit.
Little
baby. And all of a sudden, we're all Werner Herzog, and we're all like, let me see the baby.
I want to see the baby.
Let me see the baby. When I saw him for the first time, I said, John, do you understand what you have done? For the first time, you have captured the energy that was originally put into the world by the depictions of the Madonna and child. This is the Messiah, John Favreau.
Chaos reigns, John.
Yeah, it was so cool. And I want to acknowledge something, too. Ziegler and I were talking about this like when we were getting the Zoom started up. The movie's... The latest trilogy was a disappointment. That said, we also grade this stuff on a different scale, which I think is a huge strength for the TV offerings, right? Yeah. Like Kathleen Kennedy, J.J. Abrams, et al. Got to make 3 movies, and we judge them on those 3 movies. On the TV side, it's like Clone Wars, which spanned 133 episodes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And some of those suck, but we don't care.
Yeah.
You're never going to talk about the fact that some of those... I didn't watch Resistance. I watched some of it. It wasn't for me. I love Rebels. But like the fact that on the TV side, they get all of these at-bats. They get all of these chances to tell a story. And you know what? If 3 episodes here, 4 episodes there, a 2-episode arc here doesn't hit, we don't fucking give a shit. But if the movies suck... you're going to hear about it. So there is a different way that we talk about these properties. And it's a little bit unfair for JJ and Kathleen because, you know, they only got those 3 chances. Whereas on the TV side, they got dozens and dozens and dozens of chances over multiple seasons to get it right or get it wrong.
Yeah. I mean, I will say it would have been nice if JJ and everybody decided to have a plan when they made those 3 movies rather than just going a little willy-nilly with it. Because on TV, they plan. You plan a lot.
I feel like they had one, but again, you can feel the filmmaking by committee in those movies.
You can feel the panic.
You can feel that there, you know, somebody, some executive somewhere was like, there's not enough kids with the Force in here. Can't one of these stable hands have the Force or something? And they're like, oh, shit. Now we got to rewrite. And you had to address it. But you felt, and the Last Jedi feels the least of that. But you feel it in all of them where it's like there's stuff in Rise of Skywalker where you're like, it hooks up to nothing else. It's just like a snippet that happens. It's like, hey, what is that? Like, where's that?
Somehow
we gotta give Finn a love interest because you can't date a black person can't date a white lady in the future in space. That's too much.
Like what
Like what?
Yeah, like what? So what are the futures of the movies? Like one thing that is for sure is the people at Disney are smart. They may have made three like disappointing movies, but these are people who think about this shit all the time. Like, so how do y'all think they'll recalibrate in the future? And how will they approach movies now to work in conjunction with this burgeoning slate of TV offerings, plus the comics, plus the books, et cetera?
You know, I think that they're going to really use sort of this space that they're creating with television to get a feel for what people are really responding to and really start to understand that storytelling is changing and the way we tell stories, people want more from them. And I think that this is going to be a real opportunity for them to sort of sit back and like take a beat and take a breath and not necessarily have to put out a movie every single year and all the have all of those expectations sort of rolled into it. They're going to be able to really let the creation of new lore sort of simmer in itself and see what people are really responding to and what really resonates with what's going on culturally, which I think is really important because this trilogy that we just saw, it comes from a different culture. Like it comes from a different desire for what movies are and what movies should be. And it was just too much of a reflection of what we've seen in the past. And we're moving so much farther ahead in how we tell stories and the types of stories that we want to tell. And I think that TV gives them a much greater space of experimentation that I think they'll be able to then sort of let things rise to the top and really explore that in a big budget way.
Yeah, I mean, just that, especially that last part about the idea of experimentation, like that's where they can test things out and see what sticks, you know, like introducing the idea of like force healing in The Mandalorian before it went to the big screens. Like, I mean, Star Wars, I mean, all fans are bad. Fandom is bad in general, but like, you know, Star Wars fans are famously hate when you introduce a new power that comes out of nowhere. But when you think about it, like there was no tee up for like force lightning. Like Palpatine just like does that shit.
That made sense at the time.
Somehow
he came back and he can do force lighting, but like, you know, like that Tita, like Grogu does that in The Mandalorian, and then like Rey does, like that's a running theme throughout, you know, the Rise of Skywalker. It's like, I think that teeing stuff up that like maybe just getting like a little nugget of like, oh, this is a force power, or like this is like a thing of the universe that we didn't know. And then I think, you know, if they want to test out, like, if there's like a, if they do like, you know, they have like a Sith show or whatever, and they want to like, oh, this character's interesting, and I would like to see, it makes sense for this to come to culminate in a feature. This is a story that can only be told in a 90-minute, like, feature story act. Like, I think our structure, that would make sense. Like, but I can't see them being like, we're going to do another trilogy about another good versus bad.
Yeah.
Like, I think an interesting take would see the gray of the world, like the neutral Sith, the gray Jedi, like just seeing like how those people interact, like something that takes place after the fall of the Jedi Order, where it's just like, yeah, there are people out there sort of like Kylo Ren who are like sort of okay at being using the Force, but they can still get their ass beat by people that don't know what they're doing. Like, that's an interesting world. Just like seeing the Rogue One of it, seeing like, you know, the feet on the ground, everyday people that are like living in this post galactic or final chapter, whatever the fuck it was called. World, see what they're like. Final Order.
Yeah, well, that's what I loved so much about Visions. Like the ideas that they get into in the episodes are just, it's so exciting to see, you know, like a Ronin style story with you know, like a Sith, and just, I mean, the way that the Force, they use different aspects of the Force on different planets. Mm-hmm. I love that shit. Like, give me more of it. Like, spoon feed it to me. Yum, 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 yum. Like, that's what I want.
I mean, like, you know, as a kind of like basic storytelling rule, there should always be new information.
Yeah.
And that's the great thing about Star Wars Visions is... Yes, we're exploring kind of like the core themes of Star Wars, the duality of the Force, you know, droids, a human relationship with droids, cool laser swords, etc. But it also just feels so fresh and new. This has been so fun. Up next, the Endgame. We're in the end game now, and this week we are playing the Medal of Yavin, in which we will award that great medal that Chewie didn't get at the end of Star Wars for basically racial reasons. Like, why didn't he was so important to the mission to blow up the Death Star, and then he doesn't get a fucking medal. It's honestly insane, and I still get mad about it. But we are going to award the Medal of Yavin to our favorite character from the first three episodes of Star Wars Visions. Let's start with you, Cody. Who is your favorite character?
I got to give a word to my boy, to my Slug King Geezer, the Hup. He's holding it down for all the fell sons out there in the universe. With his space garage rock band playing that double bass or double space bass, whatever they called it. I love a good Hut that's going through his punk phase. And since they live for thousands of years, I'm imagining Geezer's probably like 200 years old. So like, I love yes. it. Yeah, we stand a king.
Alicia.
I have to go. I have to say this is unusual for me. I'm not usually like a big Sith person, but the bandit leader, Lucy Liu's character in the duel.
She's great.
She deserves a medal just for the crazy swirling lightsaber umbrella thing. Like, yeah. I'm sorry. That is like one of the most badass things I've ever seen. And I mean, I also really the little chief in the Ronin, that sweet yeah. little chief
was...
he's actually probably deserves it more than the actual terrible Sith overlord that Lucy Liu played. She was just so badass, like I couldn't get enough.
She was incredibly bad.
Points for style.
Oh my god, style it's... points for days.
Yeah,
when she lets her like her hood just like fly, yes. to reveal her hair, yeah. I was like, yes. I also love the bandit leader, but you know what? In order to keep it different, I'm going to pick the twins together, Carrie and Em. I'm going to pick them as one person who together kind of embody the duality of the Force and the constant struggle between light and dark. And of course, for their incredible use of hyper stylized violence
yeah.
and massive destruction and immense power in the seemingly frail bodies of two individuals. They contain so much power and force, and it was just it was incredible to watch. They're gonna have to share the medal. They'll figure out a way to do
they'll slice it down the middle with one of her many lightsaber arms.
Yes, I was. So that medal's for them. Let me just leave it in a room and walk away. I don't want to hand it to them because I'll probably get cut up into a million pieces. That's it for the end game. Let us know whether you agree or couldn't disagree more, or have your own Medal of Yavin winner. Get at us at hashtag XRV Endgame. That's XRV Endgame. Cody, Alicia, thanks for joining us on another episode of XR Vision. Plug, plug, plug. Where can we find y'all next?
If you want to find me, yay for Zig across all them social media platforms, baby, that's where I be. Check out Amazing Spider-Man number 79 yes! and 80, baby. Yeah, I got that dropping out. So yeah, that's where I be.
Amazing. And that's I'm so at Alicia Lutz on all the things, Twitter, Instagram, not Facebook. And that's where I post all my stories and all my silly thoughts. So yeah, you can check me out there.
Join us each week on Wednesday, our new regular release day, for your weekly dose of the deepest dives, hottest takes, etc. May the Force remain with you. May it be with you. Carry it with you wherever you go, folks. X-Ray Vision is a Crooked Media production. The show is produced by Chris Lord and Saul Rubin. The show is executive produced by myself and Sandy Gerard. Caroline Reston and Carlton Gillespie are consulting producers. Thank you to Brian Vasquez for our theme music and our editing and sound design today. Sarah Gibalaska and the folks at Chapter 4. Sarah, thank you for doing this from your vehicle today. I super appreciate it, and it's been fun to watch over Zoom. Goodbye! Cody, who is the tastiest Star Wars alien? Like, if you had to cook them up.
Oh boy, this sounds. I mean, the Salacious Crumb comes to mind because his last name says Crumb. So I feel like he's probably like some tasty liver fat going on.
I've always maintained that Admiral Akbar was just like some salt.
Oh boy,
and
yeah,
some, and some lemon. You sear that bad boy up.
Yeah,
and he's gonna taste.
Oh yeah,
so fucking good.
Pull out those pin bones. I bet him and what was the squid dude? Kit Basho.
Oh yeah, Kit Basho.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah, he, but get those cut those tentacles off and like just like fry those up.
Salt and pepper, little fish paprika. Sauce. Yeah.
Yeah, like oh fuck yeah.
Stir fry.
I'm late for a very important date.
Time is running out to score adult theme park tickets at child prices from Undercover Tourist. This summer, make your Walt Disney World vacation more affordable than ever. Escape into a place where magic has the power to transport you into stunning worlds and your favorite stories for less. Buy from Undercover Tourist, an authorized seller, and link to official Walt Disney World apps so you can add on Genie Plus and Lightning Lane upgrades easy. Book your adult theme park tickets at child prices with Undercover Tourist now and save. UndercoverTourist.com.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.